Welcome to Next Us 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I'm your host, Jock JC. The inaugural season of Next Us 818 Podcast features descendants of the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion. I am pleased to welcome to Episode 5 a descendant of Indiana Hunt Martin, who served in the 6888. My guest tonight is Janice Martin, the daughter of Indiana Hunt Martin. Welcome, Janice.
Good evening, Dr. JC. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Wonderful. I'd like
to start with a few interesting facts that you shared with me. First, the U.S. Congress recently voted unanimously to designate the U.S. Post Office facility located at 170 Manhattan Avenue in Buffalo, New York, as the Indiana Hunt Martin Post Office Building.
Yes.
That formal dedication honoring your mom will take place in coming months.
Yes, it will. And we are all in the family. We are just so thankful for everybody who was involved. When they first presented it to us a couple years ago, Debbie Ransom, who lives here in Buffalo, said, "Oh, we're going to try to get the post office named after your mom." I said, "Oh, okay. And I had mentioned it to someone who works in veteran affairs. They said, "Oh, no, that can't happen because that has to go through Congress. That's an act of Congress. So what they'll probably do is just put her name in there and, you know, say a few words and yada, yada." I said, "Okay, even that would be wonderful to see." And I had told mom because she was still living. But then as things started rolling, then we saw the bill in Congressman Higgins presented the bill to the Senate and to the Congress. And, you know, it went through and nothing much was going on. And then in the beginning of this year in March, when they passed their Congressional Gold Medal, Congress passed for the post office. I thought it was done, but then you have to understand how bills are passed, and I did learn. Now it's the next step of getting it introduced into the Senate. And we waited and waited and nothing was happening. So Edna, God bless her, Colonel Cummings, she started sending out those emails, getting information, finding out from whom, where we go next. And then it was Senator Schumann and Senator Hildebrand were the ones from New York State that needed to be involved. So
okay, Chuck Schumer and Kristen Hildebrand.
Yes. So those two were contacted with emails from different people we sent out and started sending emails to them. And then next thing I know, I got the call that it had passed through the Senate and we were just waiting on President Biden to sign it. And he did that. And so now we're waiting to get our copy.
Well, that's very exciting. The second interesting fact is that you had a chance to meet the last seven living members of the 6888 Battalion.
Yes. I tell you, I felt like a kindergartner sitting there looking at these women. I mean, I just kept saying, wow, all of them were together. And what was fascinating is when you asked each, you know, them the question, not letting them hear you ask the other one, they almost gave you the identical comment. And my mind gets, I said, now, why are they all sounding alike?
What was the question?
What did you do over there? How was it? Was it hard work? Did you run into any kind of problems? And each one said the same thing. We had a job to do it. We did our best. We got it done and we came home.
Okay.
The end.
No nonsense.
No. Even my mother wouldn't tell me much at first until we really started asking deeper questions. But that was all she had ever told me as a kid. We did mail and we got it out to the soldiers and that was it. And I kept saying, why? And to me, that question still rattles in my head. Why? What were they told not to say, or what really went on? But for them all to say the same thing, even the children say the same thing that they've asked their parents, and that's basically all they ever heard growing up, with those same lines.
So you say it sounds like you say there's a mystery there somewhere.
Yes. What did your mom tell you?
I don't remember her. I don't remember her making a mystery out of it. Now my sister may remember, or my brother may remember more than I do about that. She talked a lot about the adventure
Ah.
and all of the places that she visited when she
Yes.
was there.
But nothing much about what went on inside.
That's true. And so the third interesting fact I wanted to share at the outset was you were present when the Speaker of the House, the Honorable Nancy Pelosi, signed the 6888 Congressional Gold Medal document. How did that
Whoa.
come? How did that happen? And what was that
Edna.
like?
Edna and Liz, Colonel Cummings and Staff Sergeant, I believe, Liz Helm Frazier. Oh my goodness. When we got the word that they were going to sign, that Nancy was going, sorry, Speaker of the House Pelosi was going to sign, we asked if we could come. And they said, well, some of the descendants, by all means. So five of us descendants went in. They let us sit. They let first we went in for the vote, and that was with oh gosh, Congresswoman from Kansas. What was her name? Oh gosh, I can't think of her name at the moment. Just went right over. But anyway, well, we watched the voting. Then the next week they said we could come and sit with Speaker of the House.
Was it from Kansas or Wisconsin? Was it Gwen Moore
Gwen Moore.
from she's from Wisconsin.
Is it Wisconsin?
Yes,
Okay.
it was
I thought it was Kansas.
the senator from Kansas was
Moran?
Moran. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Wisconsin. Yes. Okay. So she let us watch the voting in her office. The next week, we were given the okay to come in, and Speaker of the House Pelosi wanted to. She signed and gave each one of us an ink pen and gave us all the new female coin that's out now. And but it was really something to be in her office. She was so pleasant. She took pictures with us, and it was really a nice, very informal setting. And I don't know, it was just a really a wonderful moment to see this bill for the Congressional Gold Medal finally signed.
That must have been incredible. I've only met
Oh.
I met her in California when I used to live there. Not when she was Speaker of the House, but she's quite a force to be reckoned with.
She's
So,
so tiny, and she is so tiny.
so those are pretty incredible and interesting facts. So let's talk about your mom, Indiana Hunt Martin, and let's go back to the beginning. So she's originally from a little town called Uvalde, Georgia. They moved to upstate New York. How did
Yep.
she, how did she, how'd that move come about?
Her father was a little special.
As
And
many of our fathers were. So.
they he was a sharecropper, and he would get into scuffles with men over women. And so he had to get out of town in a hurry because they were looking for him for lynching. Yeah, so they had to sneak him out of town in a truck. And he sent for the family. And then that's when my mother, her two older brothers, and my grandmother, they came up after he was here for a while. And they settled in Niagara Falls, which is in itself, in fact, I'm having a meeting on Friday for the Black Pioneers. Mom was a member of that because they were the first African Americans or Blacks to really get going in Niagara Falls. So, and they set up this organization because every year on the second Tuesday, I remember it as the only day we were allowed to go to this beach in Canada, because that was the only time Blacks were allowed on that beach, was that second Tuesday. So they kept that same date, so it was called the Old Pioneers, and we're meeting on Friday to try to set up a museum or display something in Niagara Falls, because Mom has notes on everybody she ever knew in Niagara Falls in alphabetical order. I found those papers when she passed. But Niagara Falls, and with them having to live in the conditions that they had, my grandfather was a street sweeper after he worked in a plant and he got laid off. He became a street sweeper. My grandmother couldn't tolerate my grandfather much longer, so she took off and left my mother at the age of 12 to raise her two younger siblings, a brother and a sister, and to take care of the father. So I think that's where some of that, as I'm looking back, I think that's where some of her strength came in, because she was in charge of the house. She went to school while taking care of them, cooking, cleaning, and still was able to graduate from high school. As one of, it was only her and another young lady that could pass. So there were two Blacks in the school, but one could pass. So. She graduated and moved on from there.
So what? How was she when she enlisted?
Okay. Mom, after she graduated, she couldn't find work as a secretary because that's what she went to school, shorthand and typing. But back then, they were not hiring Blacks to work in offices. You were either a cook, cleaner, babysitter, or lady of the night. And Mom said she did enough cooking, cleaning, and the other option was not an option for her. So she wound up getting a job picking fruit, peaches. And that didn't click on me until many years later with this peaches and her connection with peaches. But she worked on this peach factory farm, picking peaches. And it was just about the beginning of the war because she graduated in 40. The war in England, I think, had begun. And yet America was getting itself unknowingly to the people ready for the war. Because Niagara Falls, it comes out, after the government bought all the peach farms in that area, they put up what they called the TNT factory. So they called it. No one ever knew what was going on in the TNT factory. And it wasn't until 2019 that I found out and my mother found out. And she worked there and had no clue. She cleaned toilets and she made a comment to me one day. And she said, I don't understand. I was cleaning toilets, but they were never dirty. So I would just sit and read. And I said, oh, I said, what do you mean they were never dirty? He said, nobody from the back ever came out. I said, huh? So I Googled TNT factory. And when I Googled and read this article by some children that their parents were having a hard time with their farm because of the radioactive material that had been buried at the TNT factory and their farm sat on the other side of it. Well, come to find out, the TNT factory was where they were working on the Manhattan Project. Mother never, ever knew until 2019 where she was working. Because it sits in Lewiston and it's right near the waterway and the trains. So that was where they... and. Come to find out now in 2019 or 2020, they were trying to figure out what to do with all that radioactive waste, and they have to dig it up and get it out because it's seeping. And like Niagara Falls doesn't have enough problems with Hooker and Love Canal and all the other stuff. So now they've got to deal with this issue. So when I told her this, she said, huh, I never knew, but they would never come out. All I knew is I sit in there and read magazines. And while she was reading, she comes across the article in the Ebony that Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune and First Lady Roosevelt were looking for African American women to join the force. Mother never told anybody her plans. She goes down, she said, I went to the recruiting office. They didn't know what I was talking about. And they said, no, they couldn't sign her up here. She'd probably have to travel to Buffalo. And then
was that because of race? They couldn't sign her up there? Or?
Well, women signing up and African-American, these guys were not interested in even entertaining
race and gender. Okay.
With her. So what the whole issue, but, you know, women trying to join, it wasn't going to happen, especially in Niagara Falls. Black definitely wasn't going to happen, not joining United States Army. So she has to take her money, take a bus, go all the way to Buffalo. And as a kid, the Greyhound bus station sat right next to this recruiting office. And I always remember us going to visit my uncle. And my mother would point to this. And I remember this as, now that I look back, she would say, that's where I signed up at. But they didn't do anything with it. And, you know, it goes in and goes out. So she goes there. She fills out the paperwork, takes the test, comes back home, doesn't say a word, goes back to work, waits a couple of weeks, doesn't hear anything, goes back again to Buffalo to ask, have they heard anything? They hadn't heard anything. So she says, well, I tell you what, I'm going to go visit my mother in New York City because I'd like to see her before I leave if I go. So send all the information to New York City. And they said, okay. She comes back, she gets packed, goes up to New York City. She never told anybody in Niagara Falls she was joining, thinking about joining. She just told her father she was leaving and might join up. The end. Now, her older two brothers were already in CC camp. The youngest sister had already moved with my grandmother in New York City.
Now, what's CC camp?
Oh, that was the conservation camps that they had set up for the men to work in forestry. That's okay. Organization, or was pre-war, getting them trained. That's what they called it, working on clearing up the forestry post depression and trying to find work for the men. So now she gets to New York City. She goes down and asks about her paperwork, gives it a week or two, doesn't hear anything again. She goes down. They said they don't have anything. Now, here she goes again, trying to sign up. So she signs up again, takes the test again. Now, this time, evidently, they did hear within a week, she gets a card and a letter, and she kept all those papers.
Do you still have them?
Yes.
Okay.
I have them in a book where they told her to report and don't bring family. And she would be leaving from the New York and further orders would be given. So within a week's time, she got her orders and she was gone.
Where did she train?
She went to Fort Oglethorpe.
Okay, down Georgia.
Georgia. And that was her first real encounter with Jim Crow. Now, mind you, Niagara Falls had its, everybody knew their place. So Blacks knew not to go beyond a certain point, and it was understood. You don't ask to work in an office because that's not going to happen. They, quote, knew their place, so there were no big issues about Jim Crow. But when she took the train south, she always would tell me, she said that was her first encounter. And it kind of shook her up because she said it was a white guy sitting next to them in the back of the train when they pulled into D.C., the conductor very nicely walked up to the white gentleman and told him he had to move. Only Blacks could sit in the back, and he needed to go to the front. And that's when she saw the signs that said whites only, Blacks only. And she said it just gave her a chill because she didn't know what to expect. after knowing that her father had to leave the South for different reasons.
Well, you know, the irony of you telling the story is, decades later, growing up in the South myself, those things still existed.
Oh my.
So.
Ugh. And so once she arrived in Fort Oglethorpe, I had asked her, I said, well, I heard that some of the women ran into difficulty in town, going to movie theaters, walking around town. They were either spit on, beat up, and some horrible things happened to them. She said, to be perfectly honest, I wouldn't know. I said, what do you mean? She said, because I never left base. I knew better. She said, and I wasn't looking for trouble, and I knew you would get in trouble if you left the base. It was bad enough on base, she said, but she wasn't going to leave.
So what made your mom decide to enlist? Did she ever tell you that?
She read the article, and when she was in the bathroom reading papers and things, and she knew that she couldn't get a job doing what she went to high school for, secretary, office work, or anything like that. And the other options were just not in the cards for her. She said she knew she couldn't do the other things that others were doing to making a living. And so she decided, she said, well, at least this way, maybe I can do something for the war effort. Plus it would help, you know, put food on the table or give me three meals and I get a chance to travel. So when she tried to apply in Niagara Falls, they wouldn't take her application because they just said you can't sign up here.
Those are the challenges. When you described, you told me earlier that she had some real challenges trying to enlist. So this right. is an example of the kinds of challenges she faced in Niagara Falls. And then them misplacing her application several times before they finally had her, and then having to take the test again.
Right. So now she's in, now we're in New York. She gets her papers to leave. They finally accept it, and she goes, takes the train down south to D.C., and when they pull over, that was her first encounter with Jim Crow laws. The white gentleman that was sitting in the back with her, they asked him to move to the front. And she saw the signs that said blacks and whites, water fountain, bathrooms. And so once they get to the base, I had asked her what happened and did she ever leave the base? What kind of problems? She said that she really wouldn't know because she never left the base because she knew better. Knowing what all her father had went through in the South, she knew better than to leave the base. So she stayed safe on base and for those 8 weeks that they were there. And then they were transferred to Fort Des Moines. I believe that was the route it went. It was Fort Oglethorpe, then it was Des Moines, and then they were shipped out. Then they came back to New York and shipped out to overseas, from my understanding.
It was a pretty courageous thing to do for a young Black woman to enlist in the Army in the 40s, given all that was going on. What do you think made her special?
You know, I don't know if so much special. Mom didn't take too kindly to people giving her too many, I won't say she didn't take, she took orders well. She knew how to do that, but she always danced to her own drum. Nobody told her what to do unless she gave them permission.
Okay.
She had to give you permission, even me, as she became older, I had to finally get permission to do what I needed to do for her. Because once I tried, you didn't want to go up against her if she wasn't going to give you that permission. That's all I know. Even her father didn't go up against her. That was how she ran the house.
At 12.
At 12. He would get paid. And he would want to throw his money away on Friday nights. But because he had given her the money, then he would want to come back and get it, and she wouldn't give it. And they would have a lot of little knockdowns because he would never touch her, but he couldn't get the money. Let's put it that way.
you described for me your mom being determined and strong-willed. And so this is an example of one of the many examples of how that's manifested.
Oh, yes. And so she, I don't know, it was just, like I said, I don't know so much. And the people say these ladies were special. I think she saw a need for something. And when she sees a need that something needs to be done, she will see it through. At no, I mean, she doesn't care. She will see it through and deal with the consequences. If she feels something needs, she feels strongly enough about something, you can't change her. She'll go toe to toe with you. She doesn't care if you're male, female, 6 feet tall. I don't care. She went up against her nephew, a Vietnam veteran that's 110% mentally disabled. And I would have to pull her off of him. I said, Mom, please. He's not well. She says, that ain't got nothing to do with it. I said, oh boy. But that was just how, and that was her in her 80s. So I can imagine what she was like.
So what did your mom do when she completed her military service?
When she came home, she tried to find work. She heard about the GI Bill. She was working, first of all, with my aunt, who was an exotic dancer. In fact, her daughter told me they're doing a story about her mom because she was this big time exotic dancer in New York City back then. And Mom used to do her sewing and her outfits. Ma would sew her outfits and then watch the daughter and things like that. And Mom always tells me about her one chance meeting of Lena Horne. Oh, she says, boy, she said that woman was absolutely gorgeous. She says, and can you believe Lena Horne would always say, I wish I had legs like you. And my mother said, and if you notice, in Lena Horne's movies, you never see her legs. She never wanted people to see her legs. I said, oh. She said, yep. So after she couldn't find a decent job, she heard about the GI Bill. And she was a very resourceful soul. She would find things. And she went down and she applied for that. And they told her that she could start work at the Division of Labor, New York State Division of Labor, where I always mess up and called it the unemployment office. And I think she'd want to wring my neck for saying that. It's not the unemployment office. We are the New York State Division of Labor. I said, yes, ma'am. But she worked there for 4 years. And then she decided her father wasn't well, and he was there by himself. So she decided to go back to Niagara Falls. She transferred in. And when she tells me about that day of reporting for work at the office of the Division of Labor in Niagara Falls, New York, sometimes it hurts because my mother was only 5'2", 1.5", but she dressed she dressed like a New Yorker back then. And I guess some of us think the women got their style from being over in England and in France, because a lot of the women came back and when they dressed, they dressed. When she reported for this job, she walked into the office. And the office, you had to go up the steps. I remember as a kid, she said, I reported to the desk that I was here for my job. And they said, well, you have to get in line to see what jobs are available. She said, no, I'm here to work. They said, yes, you have to work, get in line. She says, no, I'm a transfer from New York City to the office to work. She said, you could hear a pin drop. And everybody stopped what they were doing and looked. Because this was a first in Niagara Falls for somebody of her color to work in the office in 1949. So They didn't know what to do with her, so they put her in the back room and let her work out of the back room until a new boss came in about a year later. And when he came, he wanted to know why was she in the back when she had more experience than all the ones up front. So he moved her to the front desk. And I think she was running her own unemployment office, because every time she heard that they were looking for blacks at some particular job, she'd get the information, come back to her community to call them up or stop by and give them this piece of paper and tell them to report there at this time and say that you're here for a job. So they would always get the jobs because they were the first ones there.
That's such an important role she played in the community.
Yes, she and one lady to this day, when we have the picnic, the Black Pioneer picnic, she always says, "I'm always so grateful to your mother. She got me my first job working in a dentist's office back in the 1950s." I said, "Wow."
Representation matters.
Yes, it does.
So did she, I know she didn't talk a whole lot about the service, but did she share any stories from her time in Europe, any adventures or painful or scary memories or?
Recently, like I said, those last 2 years, she opened up and started telling, and I guess I started asking. She told me of a couple of incidents. And the one that she would always tell me about was they were getting ready for inspection. Everybody was getting dressed. When she got dressed, one of her socks were missing. And when she went for inspection, Major Adams had told her, "What's going on?" And she said, "Well, my sock is missing. Somebody's taken my sock." And she said, Major Adams says, "A soldier is always prepared. There is no excuse for you not being prepared." So she said from that day forward, she has always been prepared. And I said, "Well, how did you manage to pull that off?" And she said, "That's not important. I was just never unprepared ever again. In fact, I had extra." I said, "I wonder what that means." She said, "That's all I'm telling you, as I was never unprepared from that day forward." I said, "Okay." And then she told me about the one trip, when they rode the Ile de France to England. She said, "They know about the bomb, the torpedo scare." She said, "But the one interesting is that it was her and the two ladies that are near her name, because they were always Hunt, Hurst, and Houston or something like that." And she said, "Well, they asked for people to volunteer to go to do KP duty, work in the kitchen." And she said, when she and they were first to go, and I said, "Okay." She said, "But from that day on, they volunteered the whole way across every day." I said, "Well, why would you do that?" She said, "There was a line all the way around the ship between the men and us to get food." And she said, "We found out after that first volunteer day that we didn't have to do anything in the kitchen but sit down and eat." She said, "The guys didn't want us. They were just happy to have females on the ship. So they did not want us to do anything. And they said, whatever they cooked for the captain, that's what they ate." So they stayed in the kitchen for all three meals for the 10 days they were on the ship and never told anybody why they were volunteering every day for every meal. She said, "We ate all the way across to England." I said, "Okay." But no, she says that they she took a lot of the tours, like a lot of the women did on the weekend. They would go into town. She said, "We would sightsee," and she even has her maps from then. She
Yes.
kept all that stuff, and I just said, "Wow."
Well, my mother took tons of photos, so we still have those. It's the black and white photos. But
she didn't take any photos, and I said, "Oh, there's one photo she has that's almost faded. I'm trying to see if I can get somebody to fix it up again. I don't know if they can, but it's almost faded." And I said, "I would love to see, because it's her, another woman, and some gentleman, and I don't know, but I said, okay, let's see what's going on here." But she really took advantage of that trip. And she said France, they went all over France, but partying at night, going to the dances, they had she said that was what was fun at night. And no one could come on base. But what I found interesting, did your mother ever tell you about them being housed with the German prisoners?
I do not recall that story.
The German prisoners were there with them in England. Yes. I said, what? Because one of them made my mom a jewelry box, and she still has it. And I said, Mom, what do you mean you were housed with the German prisoner? She said, well, they were just as happy to get away from Hitler as everybody else was. I said, okay. But in Major Adams' book, she talks about the German prisoners making their beds, the bunk beds, and things like that. So they were there with them. And that was I said, oh, I had no clue. But yeah, they were there.
So let me ask you a question. Do you recall any lessons that she learned through her service that she passed on to you or to the family? Any?
I think the biggest one is she always would say, God bless the child that's got his own. And I never really, I kind of understood, but as you get older, you do understand.
Is that part of that being always being prepared?
Uh-huh. Mom didn't like people to give her things. I mean, for me to give her something, I mean, we'd have to sometimes do a knockdown dragon. I'm serious. I mean, we would get into some big arguments. I said, Ma, I bought you this. I told you don't buy me anything. I don't want anything. And she just felt you should save your money, put your money aside. Don't spend unnecessary, save your money. And I always thought it came from that depression era, but I can see growing up the way she did, waste not, want not. And when she sees family members not putting their money aside properly, it would really irritate her. Her and her brother would get into that because he worked for a company. And it would upset her to see that he wasn't using his money correctly. Because as a single parent, for her to work, save her money, and finally be able to purchase a home, pay off her bills.
So now let's segue, Janice, and talk about you. You have many firsts in your career. So you're in the first group of Black students to integrate one of the state universities in New York. And the first class of Black students to attend the Buffalo General Hospital School of Nursing. So tell us more about your background and your career.
Well, I always wanted to go into nursing. We had an uncle that had a stroke, so I always had nursing in the back of my mind. So when I went to the first school, things didn't work out well because they weren't accustomed to us. And we were only like 17, 18, going for the sole purpose of integration. We thought it was not a big deal. We found out it was more than a big deal. Out of the 23 of us that were there, we all left that following May. I think we made it from August to May. And it was really very traumatic. One of the young men wound up committing suicide. Another one was on drugs. One had a breakdown. it was really rough. And I never really put together others who had to integrate prior to us, like down south. I never really had thought about what they went through as children. But what we went through doesn't even compare, I think, to what they went through. But this was very traumatic for all of us. Took us all quite a while to get over it. We thought we were there for the sole purpose of being part of the community, being part of everything. And what wound up happening was they had put us there to study us. So we found out.
Like you were guinea pigs.
Yes, and that's what caused all the turmoil. This one sociology professor was writing a book on our assimilation or lack of. And it, once we found out, we took steps to try to stop it. And then we found out who was running the program or supposedly overseeing us. They were taking the monies. So the chancellor had to come in and try to get to the bottom of everything. And they agreed to transfer us to another school. We get to the other university. We found out none of the monies were transferred. None of what we thought was happening was happening. And then, of course, it was during the time of Kent State. The and all those kinds of things. And we decided that somebody had hit one of the girls and it turned into a big mess. And then a riot broke out and a lot of us got into big trouble, me included. So I was sent home. And when I went home, I chose to go home. But at that point, mother started looking at my career a little differently and putting some things in place. Once we found out I was out of the trouble, and she and the friends at her job decided that Buffalo, well, it was already decided, NAACP and Urban League were trying to get Blacks into the Buffalo General School of Nursing because there was a dean there that made it clear we were not welcome there. And she had no qualms about saying it because she made it very clear she would never cap one of us. So they put things to her that she had to accept us. So they accepted that year 25 students. By the time we graduated, there were five. They did everything they possibly could to discourage us from continuing our education. But once we realized what they were up to, the few of us band together and we made it clear we weren't leaving. They'd have to put us out. So we stayed. But the interesting thing was when I first, that first day, when I told my mother, it was going to cost $9.25 for a meal ticket for the week. That meant breakfast and lunch. And I said, so how much are you planning to give me? Now, mind you, I'm 21. And I'm still thinking this is a free ride. I'm still in free ride mode. And she says, how much are the meal tickets? I said, $9.25. She said, okay, here's $10. I said, okay, but how much am I going to get to spend? She said, well, how much is left over? I said, 75 cents. She said, well, maybe with 75 cents, you can find a way to stay out of trouble. I said, what? She says, I'm not giving you a dime. She said, you don't keep putting good money on bad. And this is your last chance. If this don't work, you need to find a job. She said, because that's all I'm giving you is $10 a week. You do however you can, but maybe without money, maybe you can find a way to stay out of trouble. So I said, whoa, this sounds serious. And that's when that first bell clicked. I stayed in school. I graduated. And then we had another go round after graduation because she wanted me to get a job right away. I figured after all those years in school, I think I needed a little vacation. Still looking for the free ride. So I said, well, I'll look for a job. She said, okay. First week went by. She said, have you found a job? I said, not yet. She said, that's kind of hard for me to believe. I know I work at the Division of Labor, and I know they're always looking for nurses. I don't see why you can't find a job. Now, I didn't tell her, but I had already taken a job. But I told them I couldn't start till August. Now, this was May. I told them I couldn't start till middle of August because I was taken off the whole summer.
Second week. You're still thinking like a student, right?
Yes.
In the summer straight.
I said, I'm taking off the summer. Next week, you find a job? I said, no, not yet. She says, okay, well, I tell you what, here. I said, what is this? She said, this is the name of the lady over at ECMC at the hospital. They're looking for nurses. You need to go there. An appointment is set up for you on this day for your interview. I said, whoa. I said, well, my understanding, they're only looking for people for night shift, and I'm not working night shift. She said, you'll work whatever shift they give you. I said, well, okay. So I go for the interview, and the lady said they didn't have anything but nights. I said, no, I can't work nights. I'm sorry, I can't work night shift. So you let me know when you have a day shift. Or evening. I said, I'll even do evening. Come on, this was the 70s. 75? It was a party every day.
Yep.
Every day. I knew I couldn't work nights. So when she found out that I turned down the job, you would have thought I had committed some serious crime. She was not having this at all. She was just insisting she was going to find me a job. She kept giving me places to go to sign up. I said, no. I said, right now they're not looking. So finally she kept on and I said, Ma, I already have a job, but I don't start till August. She said, why August? I said, because I needed time off. She said, with all the trouble you've been into all these years and in and out of school, I would think you had enough time off. So once I got my job, I started working evening shift, and then I still couldn't come in on time. She wanted me in before daybreak, and that didn't work well. So I got my own apartment. And it was then that once I started to work, I mean, I was working. I had no problems. I found my own apartment. She was mad that I left home. She didn't want to help me. She was upset. But I think I was so much like her. We just couldn't make it.
Determined, strong-willed, right?
Yes. I mean, I was. I said, no. I said, I'll do it myself. And I did. And I worked my own hours. And after that, I met my son's father. And he was finishing school. So he decided he wanted to start a practice in D.C. or in Maryland. So we moved to Maryland. And then a couple years later, I moved there 79. It was after the blizzard of 77 here. And I knew I was leaving after the blizzard. I mean, I had never seen 55 inches of snow in a 24-hour period in my life. And I never wanted to see it again because we were hemmed in for 3 days. And I laugh about it because her military skills came in during the blizzard. She was at her office. They stopped the buses on Main Street. She came into Maine. I lived off of Main Street some kind of way. They told people they had to stay in the buildings, the stores and what have you. She said, I'm coming to your house. I'll be there no matter what. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, how's she going to get to me? Well, they went in this building. I'm not going to say the name because she destroyed their carpet. She put her foot on the carpet thing that they had there, was insulated.
and took her little knife that she carried in her bosom all the time and cut out her footprint so she could put it inside her shoes. She had a can of beans in her bag. She had an opener for the can. She set it on top of a heater. She ate the beans and shared it with some man, she said there. And then she took a cardboard, cut two holes out for her eyes, and put it up to her face and headed to my house. And she walked in, I couldn't believe she walked from Main Street to my house in this blizzard. But she was not staying at that place after she ate. She came on in and stayed with me for 3 or 4 days because we couldn't move. And when I saw this thing in her boots, I said, well, where did this come from? She said, well, I had to put something in my boots. I just couldn't walk. You know, I don't know how my feet were. I didn't want my feet to get cold. You got to protect your feet.
She took the to use the carpet, eh?
Yes, she did. Bless her little heart. But yeah, that's, and so then I went into psych accidentally. I wound up working psych for about 20 years. I didn't want it at first, but then I started enjoying working with the psych patients. Sometimes you can make a connect, and it was interesting to make that connection with them. And they talk with you, and you can help. And, you know, especially if you could see change coming. And back then, we would see change because they stayed about 4 weeks. So I really took to the psych. And then after the facility closed, I started going in. I got injured at one place, so I couldn't work psych anymore. So then I started doing assisted living and became director of nursing on assisted livings for the last 20 years. And now I'm doing home assessments, but with COVID, we couldn't go out anymore. So now we're just doing them on the phone, seeing what services people need to remain in their homes.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about influence. How do you think your mother's time in the 6888 influenced and shaped your life and your decisions? Or do you think that it did?
I just think the lessons she learned growing up and then the lessons she, I want to say, put into practice because they were on their own. They had to survive on their own. I think what she learned as a child, how to survive, and then now being in this environment, because I don't know if you're aware of how they picked these ladies. I didn't never hear the story of how they were chosen. I think it was Cynthia's mom said that about the letter. I mean, about the notices that were posted. And every day women would come in to see if they were chosen for this unit that was going overseas.
That's Cynthia Scott.
Yes.
And we interviewed her last week.
Right. And, yeah. And I never knew how these women were chosen. But evidently, it's a very systematic decision. I know they were interviewed again. They had to take tests again to be chosen to be in this particular unit. But like I said, I would love to know more about how they were chosen and how our mothers were all chosen for this particular unit and becoming the 6888. But it just seems like there was some quality that they were looking for. Because when I hear the different children talk about their moms, it almost sounds like they're talking about my mom. About their determination and how they just stuck to things. And then even afterwards, how they stuck to what they were doing.
How did that influence you?
My friends say I'm very headstrong and I'm my own person. I don't follow the group. I never did that. I was always, that was something a teacher told me in fifth grade. She says, you know, they're following, you're the leader and they're following you. And I couldn't put that piece together. I couldn't figure that out. She said, what you do, they do. So I need you to stop. And I couldn't put that together. And I see that a lot with even working as a nurse. I run my unit,
And it's run according to my rules. If you can't work how I want you to work and care for my patients, I have to move you on. Because they all knew that I would always say, you know, I don't mind doing maintenance, but I don't do high maintenance.
You get an amen for me on that one. So.
I will try my best to bring you along to what I need you to do to take care of my patients. I didn't like people not treating my patients correctly. And if I would try to work with you and you didn't come along properly, I'd let you know maybe this isn't what, you know, this might not be the field for you. And I can see that I get a lot of that from my mother, because she would tell me, you know, maybe you need to find something else to do. She would tell you that in a minute and tell other family members, or maybe that's not the work for you. And I say, Mom, you really shouldn't get in other people's business. She said, well, somebody needs to tell them. I said, oh, why is it you? Because then they're going to be mad at you now. But I could see it.
And that didn't bother her in the least bit, I'm sure.
Not at all. She had no problems. And the sad part is the family listened to everything she told them. Her brother, who was older, if she told him something, and even when he became ill, his wife couldn't get him to do things. And when he would act out, they would call her to come get him and talk to him. And then she would sit there, and then you would hear them getting going at it. And eventually he would give in, because she wasn't going to give in.
That's because she was in charge from the time she was 12 overseeing.
So. Yes. And her younger brother lived with her. And I mean, sometimes it would be all out war in here. And I would tell them both to knock it off. But he would then say, okay, I'll do what she wants. I said, you know, you better, because, you know, she ain't going to stop. And that was just how she did it. I mean, she made it very clear once she got involved, once you pulled her in, it was her way or the highway.
How old was your mom when she passed?
98.
Okay, and that was, when did she pass? What year?
And 2020.
Okay, very recently.
Yep.
So can you share any reflections on what her life and legacy mean to you as you think about it?
Well, you know, to see what the ladies did during the 1940s under those kinds of circumstances, with the Jim Crow situation, being the women, when women's movement was starting, because, you know, the women got the right to vote, what, in the 20s? And here it is, the 40s, these ladies decided to step up and take a stand that they wanted to be a part of this United States Army that was a men's club. To me, that took a lot to say, you know, yeah, I'm going to join too. See what I can do. And having the men even back home thinking these women were crazy for thinking about joining. And then when they did join, they didn't treat them well by the whites, by the men, even the African-American men. Part of me thinks that they were, I don't want to say treated delicately, but they were treated different than the women who stayed back in the States. The women who stayed back in the States, as far as I'm concerned, from what I have read, they caught pure hell because of the racism and the things that were going on under the United States Jim Crow laws. But in England, these women had some freedoms that they got a taste of. And they started seeing that there is a better way of life. And nobody was going to stop them from pursuing that once they even came home. Because all of them seemed to take another step up once they returned home.
You make that comment, it makes me think about so many of the artists of that period who left America for that very reason.
Yep.
And then they moved to England and to France because it was so racist here, and they actually could find more freedom.
Yes.
To live.
And they could function here.
And they couldn't stay here. Other countries.
Yeah, right. They couldn't stay here.
they go back. Some of them tried to come back and it just didn't work.
Right.
Because once they, you know, it's like they say, once you taste freedom, it's, you know, you're not going back. And I don't think these ladies were going to settle for anything less.
Yeah. I think that many of them will be very disappointed with the things that are going on now.
Oh, please.
So,
oh, it's terrible. I think we have taken such a big step backwards. It's pitiful.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Let me ask you a couple of questions a few more questions as we wrap up. What do you think about your mom's decision to serve a country given what was going on at the time in America?
I just don't, I mean, she still had no answer for me when I asked her why. She just said, you know, you had to have been there to see. She said, we were at war. And to be honest with you, we were not winning the war. She said, and so we all felt, you know, whatever we could do to help this war effort, we were willing to stand up and do whatever was necessary because they didn't know their assignment when they joined up. Right. They didn't even know their assignment until they arrived in England.
Right.
So yeah. They had, I mean, they were on this blind venture. And to stand up and take that on during that time, I just don't know how they did it.
And that's what I meant earlier when I asked about, when I commented on them being courageous. They knew they wouldn't be in combat because they didn't have women, any women in combat. They didn't give guns to women back then, but they had no idea what they'd be undertaking. And what danger that would put them in.
Not at all. And yet they signed up for this. I mean, I just couldn't even imagine. I mean, I can't go nowhere without my GPS.
Well, we've all gotten spoiled. And I know when my mother was over, all her brothers were over there at the same time.
Her brother, one was there. The other one was in Korea.
Okay. Well, Korea was later.
Okay. Well, so that was.
Yeah, that was later. My father was in the Korean conflict, but that was in the '50s, early fifties.
Oh, was it? Okay. So yeah. I know he went. I know they made him join.
That must have been the younger brother.
Yes, they made him join because he wouldn't work. So they made him join the military now. I don't know how long he was in before he went to Korea. But I think he may have gone in 1950 and she had just come out or he joined the military just before and he was stationed elsewhere. But yeah.
So given what the country is right now, do you think your mother would make the same choice to serve the nation?
I do. Because she believes, because she even said that the children today need to be taught discipline. They need to be taught how to be prepared for war, at least to follow orders. She said, right now, you all can't even follow orders. And she had made this bizarre comment. And I think it's in the video where she said, when they asked, what do you think, what, you know, the children, she said, they need to learn how to march. And I said, march? I said, what is she talking about, march? So afterwards I asked, I said, Mom, why did you say they need to learn how to march? She said, because when you march, you have to learn how to follow. You have to learn how to lead. And it's not easy to do either. Yeah. That's she true. Said, when you saw us marching, we were all in step. We looked as one. We performed as one. She said, y'all can't figure out which direction to go in. She said, she says, it's really sad. They need to learn basics. She said, it's sad that they don't have the CC camps or the someplace for the children to learn how to work as one. Rather than so much individuality. Right now, everybody's their own little whatever.
Right, right. So one final question. What lessons from your mom's life story can you share to inspire young African Americans to embrace fear as opportunity in order to shatter glass ceilings and try to be their best selves.
Oh, wow. You have to learn who you are and be your person and be comfortable with yourself and not rely on others' opinions of you. I mean, she used to always say, if so-and-so jumps off the bridge, you gonna jump too? Because I always, she said, you don't be following other people. Stop following people.
Chart your own course.
Yes, she was always wanting you to go your own way. Go your own way. Stop following people and be stronger. And she was definitely strong to the end. And she insisted that I learn how to be self-sufficient, not be dependent on others. Be your own person, she says. Even though you may have a good man or woman, still, God bless the child that's got his own. That's all she would always say. Because then you don't have to be reliant on nobody else but yourself.
That's so true. That's so true. So Janice, I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight and for sharing your family story. I am so grateful.
And I thank you, dear. So nice to meet one of us.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Next Us 818 podcast. I hope you enjoy our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I'll share a quote about determination from author Maya Angelou. You may not control all the events that happen to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them. See you for our next show on Wednesday, November 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Anchor and Spotify.